So, Velma, how did you get interested in history?
I was a journalism major and not the least bit interested in history. However, at my work at the Shrines of the Black Madonna, I was purchasing some out-of-print books. And at one point, I started buying some documents on slavery. And once I saw an original document of a person enslaved and how much this person was bought and sold for, it changed my life. And I have been a history buff ever since.
What are the kinds of things you've learned that surprised you?
In history itself, I think the majesty of who we are, even in the bad times, the camaraderie, as the book said, once upon a time when we were Negroes, we kind of had something of our own, you know, our own grocery stores, our own communities, our own banks, our own schools. And I kind of miss that, you know, this is who we are and we have to come together to remain together and to support our own selves.
So we all know that, you know, Black History Month was first Black History Week.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look back at that time period and you look at now, why has our history not been incorporated still into the history books that our children read in school?
Because our history embarrasses America. Our history tells the truth, and America still isn't ready for that. I say all the time, you can usually find a curriculum on slavery. You'll find very little on Reconstruction, because that was the period after slavery where America could have made everything right. And it started to repeal laws, and Jim Crow laws came in. And so America's still wrestling with, why didn't we treat people fairly? So we don't want to talk about it. And it's amazing, because it still is not in the curriculum as it needs to be. I was speaking to a young lady who grew up in Hilton Head, and she never heard about slavery. She's a young woman. Her sister is in school in Paulding County. And I said, well, do you all have Black History Month? She said, no. I said, well, how about a week at school? She said, no. I said, do I ask about a day? She said, no. So we're not even teaching this. And so it has to be up to the Black community to teach it.
So how do you get started teaching children about their history? And one of the things I loved about Dr. Asa Hilliard, mm-hmm. who was at Georgia State before he passed, he always said, our children should learn that our history did not start with slavery.
This is so true. And I tell them that. We did not start enslaved. I think a good way to get children to want to know about their history is to go to their family history. To ask grandma, to ask Nana, to ask Big Mama what her life was like. And they will begin to talk and they'll begin to share some things. And I think the more you ask and the more you celebrate them, the more they'll open up. Go to your churches that have history. Ask who some of the older members were. Ask some of the struggles. Go to the library. Librarians will talk to you all day long. So start local. Start close to home. And I think that love will grow.
So coming from Detroit, Michigan, to the South.
To the South.
Why?
Well, I'm a graduate of Howard University, and then I decided to come South. I have a sister who moved to Alabama. She was that other migration. As my mother said, we left Alabama going to Detroit. We had no idea y'all was go back to the South.
But that's happening a lot.
That is happening. And so I came here and I went to Emory, and that's how I came to Atlanta.
So how did you get interested in specifically the history of Georgia, Black history, and specifically Atlanta Black history?
Because I'm a newcomer, as they say, even though I've been here 30 plus years. And Atlanta is a very vibrant city. And I think I was really taken with Auburn Avenue, and in particular, the history of the Odd Fellows organization and the Odd Fellows building.
Now, explain to people who don't know, what were the Odd Fellows?
The Odd Fellows were like a fraternal organization, extremely popular. The one that was here in Georgia was the richest chapter in the South. And so you have the Odd Fellows building on Auburn Avenue, Benjamin J. Davis, who was also the editor of the Atlanta Independent. And you have to read that newspaper to find out what was happening in the early 1900s here in Atlanta and in Georgia. And just to read it and to visualize and to see how Atlantans, Black Atlantans, overcame so much and built so much, it was just very fascinating.
And that was the beginning.
That was the beginning. I've been hooked ever since.
Well, let's talk about some little known Black history facts about Atlanta. Let's share some.
Atlanta. I love talking about the Odd Fellows. That's really my heart. From that organization, they created a farm down in Middle Georgia. Black-owned through the organization. It was probably vibrant for about a couple of years, 1915, 1917, but it was a way of saying that Black people can come together and own land. Of course, we love the history of our schools, the Atlanta University Center. I love the history of the West End. I love some of the changing history in the West End from when it was all white to the 70s when it became Black, and now you see it's changing again. But I think sometimes we just have to stake a claim in our history. Auburn Avenue has just attracted me. I've done an article on the Gold Dust Twins.
Who were the Gold Dust Twins?
The Gold Dust Twins were a popular, I guess, trademark for gold dust washing powder. Now, you will see this image, which is probably over 100 years old, on the side of one of the buildings, the Atlanta Life Branch Building on Auburn Avenue. So it is not a complimentary image of us. They're two young Black men who are dressed in tutus selling the gold dust washing powder. And so when you look at it, you kind of stop and say, where did this come from? Well, during the tornado, the building next to it came down, and there it was. It had been hidden for about 80 years. And so the question is, what do you do with the Gold Dust Twins? Do you cover them up? Is this a history you want to talk about? How does this fit? And my take on that is, I want that image to stay there for two reasons. So that our young people will know what we've been through. And two, because while that image was there, Auburn Avenue was booming. So it was a juxtapose. It was they say we're this, but we have proven that we're this, that we have businesses, that we have organizations. And it's a vibrant reminder of don't get caught up in the madness. Know who you are and what your people have done.
Well, that's a lesson for today.
That is.
So let's talk about some other buildings along Auburn Avenue. The churches.
Oh, yes. Our churches have always been the bedrock of our communities. And even when we talk about the Atlanta Business League, where they had sessions, you would always see Big Bethel mentioned and Wheat Street mentioned, because those were places we could congregate. They were large enough to accommodate our programs and our conventions. And so they were always bedrocks in the community, very much involved in whatever was going on.
And you mentioned the Atlanta Business League. Last week, Leona Barr Davenport, the executive director, was on. Tell us about the history of that organization.
Well, it has a very interesting history in that it started really in the early 1900s. It was not called that. There were different organizations that took on that order of saying, what can we do to enhance Black businesses? So you may have the Colored Merchants Associations. You may have the Negro Chamber of Commerce. But all in still, they were all coming together to say, how can we unite? How can we improve business? How can we get together and know who's doing what and what works? How can we hire our own people? And so it has an early history here in Atlanta.
I love when I walk Auburn Avenue also, not only to see the churches, the Odd Fellows Building, but the newspaper that is still, I think, the oldest continuously running newspaper in the U.S., the Atlanta Daily World.
The Atlanta Daily World.
Although now the Atlanta Daily World building is something else entirely.
It is. And they suffered a lot of damage with that tornado, but Auburn Avenue is changing.
You don't sound happy about it.
I need to go down there and look again. There are some Black businesses that still have stake, and so we do need to support them. But we really wanted to remain the mecca, the economic mecca, so that when people come to Atlanta, I don't want to have to tell my people when they're touring Atlanta that what used to be here was. You know, everything is what used to be. I want to say this is still here. This is still maintained and is sustaining. I don't like for you to have to try to imagine what it looked like when there were Black businesses. Why can't we look at it and see today what it's like to have Black businesses?
I also know Hogger Books Funeral Home. That's been there forever.
Forever, yes, yes, yes. And there was
Cox Funeral Home was 100 years old.
Yes. There was a barbershop that closed. I think it was Blue Moon or something with Moon a few years back that stayed in that family for a long time. And anybody who was anybody had their hair cut there.
Which, of course, takes us to Atlanta's first Black millionaire, Alonzo Herndon.
Right, who was a barber and a self-made millionaire. And you can see his imprint. It's amazing because I took my nephew to the street where the Herndon home is. And there was a smaller cottage, and then it was his mansion. And so I asked him, so which one do you think was Alonzo Herndon's home? And he looked and he chose the smaller one. And then I had to tell them, no, the larger one is where he stayed. But see, this isn't being taught. So our children don't know that we've done great things. They go to the minimal and say, that must be black. But that's not always true.
So the history of Atlanta also has some very painful moments mm-hmm. in it. Mm-hmm. And I think about the riots that affected that whole area downtown that we're talking about right now.
Right.
So talk about that a little bit.
And that's something because in 1906, Atlanta hosted the annual conference of the National Business League in August of 1906. And some of the newspapers would say, wow, you know, Atlanta has really, at this point, opened its arms that some of the Jim Crow laws were relaxed, particularly with the streetcars. And so you would read that article, let's say, in September of 1906. And then by September the 20th, there's a race riot. And so you're seeing how difficult it is even to stake your claim here. Because Atlanta does have some very painful history. And it was a number of years before I heard anything about that race riot. And the commission that really just dug in their heels and said, no, this is the 100th year that we're going to memorialize this and really push so that people would learn about that race riot. And when you think of a race riot, sometimes we say, oh, black people were tearing up stuff. No, white people were attacking us. And so there's a whole history here that needs to be told.
See, my mother always said we should learn from our history so that we don't make the same mistakes in our present and in our future.
Yes.
I love to hear you talk about what it was like then and how we have not been able to duplicate that now. Now, the AU complex is still there, turning out educated
yes.
people. But what isn't happening?
I think what isn't happening is that we're not supporting black businesses like we should. I think somewhere along the line, we convinced ourselves that the white man's ice is colder. And people point a lot to, well, you know, once we integration was allowed, then, you know, that allowed us to go anywhere. Well, I'm saying, well, I'm not for segregation because if I'm paying my tax dollars, I want the same benefit as everyone else. But that allowed us to have a choice. And we chose not to support ourselves. And that is our fault and our biggest downfall.
That is so interesting, because when I mention to people how I have a mixture of doctors, but the majority of them are African American, mm-hmm. they always look at me like, what's wrong with you?
Oh,
that brings up a point. We oftentimes will judge ourselves and judge our businesses very differently
yes.
than what we do a majority-owned
that
business.
That is very true. So one mistake or mishap at a black business, and we're going to label them all as terrible. But you can go in other businesses and have a bad day, but you just say, well, I'll go back again. But that's the whole psychology that we have to break. And organizations and groups support themselves. That's only natural.
So give me some more interesting black history facts.
I know we talked about the race riot. The Freedmen's Bank. There was a Freedmen's Bank here in Atlanta.
Okay, let's talk about that. And that's important because you're right. During Reconstruction, so much happened, and then it went away.
Right.
So, you know, we think of banking with just the major banks.
Right.
We have Capital City Bank. We do have, quote, African-American-owned banks. So tell us about the Freedmen's Bank.
Well, the Freedmen's Bank was started during Reconstruction, and it was a place, they said, so that back then the Negro could save his money and put it in a safe place. And so we were coming out of enslavement, and so we began to amass some funds, and so we put it in this particular bank, and there were branches throughout, particularly the South. And it was a good deal until they changed the charter of the bank. It was not supposed to be a lending bank. And then they allowed people to borrow from that bank, and then they borrowed on deals that went sour, and then the economy went bad. And so you had all this money that was lost. And they said that was a tremendous blow to African Americans. You had churches that saved. You had fraternal organizations that saved. You had washerwomen that saved. You had groups that saved. And to have that money just poof, disappear was a terrible blow to us.
I wonder if that's why so many people in my grandmother's generation did not trust banks.
Didn't trust them. They tuck it under that mattress, you know, push it in their bosom. But they didn't trust the banks.
another fact you want to share?
I'd have to think a little bit more.
I saw the beauty on a side street off of Auburn Avenue. Mm-hmm. There is a beauty salon where I was told that Madam C.J. Walker would come and do hair and sell her products. Hair.
I haven't been to that museum, but I really want to go. That whole Poro, that whole industry of black women's hair care was very influential and substantial here. And I think that is such an empowerment for black women. You know, sometimes we look at Madam C.J. Walker and they said, oh, she was just trying to straighten people's hair. No, she was giving black women an opportunity to be financially successful and independent. Her products helped to heal our scalps because under enslavement, we didn't get the nutrients that we need. And so our hair was falling out in clumps. So it wasn't a matter of straightening your hair. It's a matter of getting the nutrients that you need into your system. And so women were able to take this and go door to door and, as my mama would say, have their own money, which was something, you know, back in the day. And to feel good and to have your conferences and know what's going on with the other organizations, women were stenographers. And it was just a matter, you see their names. I'm gosh, black women, we were doing all of this. And sometimes we outshined the black men. You know, the Odd Fellows, when they were raising money, they would always say, the women's organization in auxiliary has raised more. And I said, are we really surprised? You know, and so just that empowerment of being a black woman and being able to stand on your own two feet.
So when you look at the history of Auburn Avenue, how it got its name, Sweet Auburn.
Sweet Auburn. It had to be sweet. I mean, to be able to go somewhere and feel comfortable, to have your entertainment there, to have all of your shops there, to have your doctors there, because, you know, you had the Black Medical Association, which was meeting here, to have everything you needed right there, and you never had to really look around and wonder what's going to happen. It had to be sweet. And people were looking at Atlanta and saying, wow, look at all this that's going on.
What I find fascinating is when young children are on Auburn Avenue and even some adults, and they see that statue of John Wesley Dobbs, just his face, and they always go, well, who's that?
Who is that?
And you have to explain, John Wesley Dobbs, he was the civil rights leader. He was the grandfather of the first black mayor of a major city,
yes,
in the South, Maynard Jackson.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you realize this line of what I called of civil rights activity from grandfather down to grandson.
Grandfather. And I think that's something that still needs to be instilled. You have to carry on the legacy. One generation can only do so much. And so the next generation has to pick up that mantle and move forward. Now, they may not move forward in the way that we moved forward, but you got to move forward. You have to be engaged. You have to be involved, because if you sit down for one generation, that's going to affect at least two. And we don't have time to catch up. We need to be moving forward and staying ahead of the game.
And that, I guess, raises for me the issue of what our children are doing now. Many of them don't know their history.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, not even their family history.
Right.
So to instill this love from the past and to learn from the mistakes of the past, what do we do? I guess it's one of those ethereal questions. You know, how can we? My mother used to take me to the colored library, because mm-hmm. that's what it was called. And we would read and read and read. And I wonder if parents still do that with their children. Because there's the collections of life and heritage right there on Auburn Avenue.
Right there.
At Cortland.
Right. I think we as a generation, black or white, we're not reading like we used to. And I find that very disappointing, because you really have to read, and you have to read something from the time period. So if I need to know what went on in the 1930s, I'm going to go to the Atlanta Daily World. If I need to know what went on in the 1920s, I'm going to go to the Atlanta Independent. And so you read and you get the firsthand account of what's going on. Sometimes I think we are so stressed and doing so many things that to have that quiet time with our children just doesn't rise to the top. Now, where I work at a nonprofit, I'm going to give it a plug, the Healy Community Center, one of the things that we do is that as children come in to see their pediatrician, we give them a book. And children love books to this day. They love books. If you sit a child on your lap and begin to read and turn those pages, I'm not talking about swiping the screen, I'm talking about turn those pages. There is still something that sparks an interest. It might be just hearing your voice, hearing the mother's or someone's, a caregiver's voice read to them, that it still sparks that interest. And reading, as one of my researchers told me, one of the people I look up to, he said, it belongs to the one who's willing to sit in the chair. Mm. It's not a glamorous job. Your family will look at you like, is she still in the library? But you sit there, and when you take it in, you begin to see the possibilities. If it happened once under even harsher circumstances, it can happen again if this is what we want.
Mm. So talk about the royal peacock. Okay. So you want to talk about that one. Okay. So what other building along there other than the Oddfellows, the SCLC building, is that, are those on a historic registry yet?
That might be part of that whole
line.
Right,
yeah.
of the Martin Luther King Center. I think all of that is part of a historic site. So they should be captured in that.
They should be. I need to look that up. So when you look at our history as African Americans in the city of Atlanta, what makes you proud and what makes you question?
What makes me proud? What makes me proud would be the AU Center. What makes me proud is the history of neighborhood union. When black women decided in the early 1900s that black children did not have a safe place to be. And so they decided that we're going to create something safe for black children.
And what was it called?
Neighborhood Union. And it's over in Vine City. Neighborhood Union Medical Center is still there. The Healing Community Center is part of that. And so they were also the place where you came to get your health care. And so a lot of people who grew up in the 60s and 70s will say, I remember that building. I went there for such and such. You know, as a friend said, I found out I was pregnant.
You know, I got my flu shot here for 40 years, uh-huh. And I've never heard of that.
Oh, you would love the history of the neighborhood union.
Tell me more.
Dr. Hope Franklin, Lugina Burns Hope. She was the wife of Dr. John Hope, president of the AU Center. And she and a number of influential women got together and said, our children need a safe haven. Our children need health care. And they created this organization. So you would have women from the National Association of Colored Women. I mean, these were women who were independent of their husbands' professions. And they decided they were going to build an organization, build a group to take care. And they have been moving strong ever since. Now, the organization is defunct, but the institution is still there. And we need to know that in the Vine City area, which gets such negative publicity all the time, that there's a rich history there of leaders who came out there, who were born there, and just the history that says we kind of took care of ourselves. You know, we were here, we saw, and we did what needed to be done. We didn't ask anybody's permission. We did what needed to be done.
So when you see what's happening in the Vine City area, mm-hmm, now, mm-hmm, in the old Fourth Ward, mm-hmm, some people say our history is being erased.
And, you know, I think they're right. So here's the challenge, the oral history. And that we must own. You better get those snapshots, get those pictures, those little Polaroid pictures from those old cameras that you had growing up, the family photos, and you need to tell your story. You need to record it, and you need to tell your story. We need to tell our own stories, because if we're looking for material evidence, that may not always be there. But we can hold on to our stories.
Beautiful. Very good. We went over a little bit, but I don't mind.